Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Sally Potter, whose new album, Anatomy, is out May 2nd via Bella Union. The record features songs that concern themselves with the interconnectedness among humans and the connection that humans share with the Earth. Potter is also an internationally acclaimed film director, having made films such as Orlando and The Party. Although she's composed film scores in the past, Anatomy is her second traditional album. We discuss the record, her appreciation of the planet, and her appreciation for her collaborators on this effort and others in this conversation, which is coming up now. You've done a lot of music over the years, but this is really your second album in the sense, I guess, that we think of them. Do you remember what kind of inspired this initially?
Well, subject matter in terms of the lyrics was really thinking about what do we need to be able to have a future at all in these apocalyptic times. And it was to have, you know, had to have an earth that lives and breathes and on which we can grow food and isn't about to blow up and so on. So to make songs that come to the theme of our existence on earth, our interconnectedness with the earth, with all living things and with each other, to celebrate it and also in a way sing out a warning that if we get disconnected, we won't have an earth, and if we don't have an earth, we don't have a future. Humanity is finished. So it feels like kind of a crucial subject, to put it lightly, to come at. But of course, a lot of people either wish to go into denial about what's happening with climate and the exploitation of the earth, because the feelings are too great. They bring up so many feelings of death and doom and catastrophe that people almost would rather not believe it and would rather believe that it will kind of go away or we'll find some kind of solution, tech solution or something. So I wanted to make songs that came at it in not in a judgmental way, no finger pointing really, but saying, hey, let's remember that we are in a love affair with the earth. These are love songs to the earth and to each other and to our future, at the same time as grieving for the losses. So that was the lyric challenge. The music, I think, just came out of the same desire that I have when I write all songs that I've ever written, which is just to write a good song, to write a song that I want to hear. That I want to sing, but I want to hear above all when I'm writing it. And that starts with, you know, things you can hardly put into words, really, but a chord sequence, how a harmony works, how one kind of instrument works with another, how a melodic line works, all the musical issues that are almost beyond language, really, to talk about. You can talk about them technically, but you can't talk about what that feels like when you put an A minor with a C minor or whatever it may be you're doing.
This thing that you said about music going beyond language, it's interesting to me because obviously as a writer and so forth, you've spent a lot of time thinking about language and spoken word and so forth, but you're dealing with this stuff that's not you feeling it, not articulating it. Is that, do you think, some sort of relief of, you know, at times from being constantly aware of words and their meanings and their implications?
Well, I love words. And of course, one of the songs is called Words, and it's a celebration of words and also a warning about the corruption of language when there's a lot of words being used untruthfully or incorrectly or lies, in a word. So I think language itself is the most beautiful and extraordinary invention. I mean, how did we do it as humans? You know, it must have started with a grunt and a cry or something, and the cry that started to mean there's an animal coming or whatever it may be. It formed itself into this incredibly complex system of communication, which is different in many, many tongues. Different sounds mean the same thing, but allow us to visualize and think about the same thing. So I don't find words to be a limitation. I find them to be an endless kind of miracle. But there's something about sound and pure sound, or musical sound, instrumental sound, harmony, melody, which somehow reaches in to the mind in a way that is quite metaphysical. It's an experience. It's a feeling. It's a feeling of reaching for the stars. You know, it's not surprising people talk about, you know, the sort of the sound of the stars or this sort of celestial feeling. You feel when you really engage with music, with pure sound, that you're touching something invisible, ineffable, and magical when it's good. and moving and so on. And a lot of people feel their strongest feelings when they listen to music. So when you marry music with words in the form of lyrics, which is really a form of poetry, you're dealing with two very kind of high forms coming together, but you're also dealing with the oldest form, when people started singing and singing tunes and singing words or greetings or celebrations or whatever. So you're dealing with an incredibly long form through time, and an incredibly evolved form, and an incredibly popular form that millions and millions of people relate to every day. So it's a wonderful medium to work with.
I had this realization that the best art, but music, especially, you know, for a long time I thought about, oh, it's just going in my ears. But if it's really doing its job, if it's really good and it's really moving me, I feel it throughout my whole body.
Yeah. Well, that's like people who don't have hearing in the ears but can still play wonderful music, like Evelyn Glennie, the percussionist who is completely deaf, plays with bare feet on the floor and feels it all through the vibrations in the floor, and is an orchestral player, you know, playing incredibly complex scores. So there are many ways of hearing. And at least one of them is literally the vibrations in the floor under your feet. But also there are resonances in your bones. Anybody who sings knows that, for example, it feels very different when you're singing from somewhere low in your chest, or when you're singing much higher, it's somewhere up in your head. And all your bones are resonating. You hear through the head bones, not just through the ears.
Yeah, it's really something. It's remarkable. And you know, to go back to this idea of the earth and how we've sort of treated it, it's remarkable to me. So I'm 52, and in my lifetime in the United States, we saw around the time I was born, we saw the founding of the Environmental Protection Agency, and this recognition that there were environmental hazards and that we're going to clean this up. And now we're going in this backwards, moving away from this, as though it's like, haven't we seen this? And it's you touched on this. There's this very confusing thing that we humans do, which is to see something and deny it.
Because it's fearful. And aren't we able to use the fear that we have as a call to action, to creative action about it, to do something. Instead, the fear becomes a kind of paralysis and a sort of turning the head away from reality. And of course, when that's backed up governmentally or politically, it becomes extremely dangerous, extremely dangerous.
And as you say, I mean, the creativity of it, it's sort of like, why then aren't we using this creativity that we have for all these amazing machines and so forth to figure out ways to have cleaner streams and so forth, you know?
Well, we could all be living in paradise, according to some things that I've read anywhere. You know, if the Earth's resources were shared equally, evenly, and creatively, then we would all have enough to eat, we would all have enough water to drink, and we would all be surrounded by greenery. And well, it depends on the climate of which part of the world you are, how close you are to the equator. There'd be different landscapes, different life forms and vegetation forms. But there isn't enough for some people because other people have got too much. So some countries have got too much and some individuals have got a lot too much. And this also means that great vast numbers of people are in want and suffering through a fundamental lack of sharing of the Earth's resources in a logical way that's better for everybody. And that's not just airy fairy utopian thinking, feeling rather. It is thinking in that I've read various studies who study the Earth's resources and the population and how, if it was shared correctly and properly and distributed correctly and properly, we indeed all could be living in some sense in our earthly paradise.
In Coming Home, this is a case where the instrumentation to me is really fascinating, because the drums there, this is a piece that deals with a train, right? I believe a tree that was removed to make way for progress. And this rhythm track just builds so slowly, it's almost imperceptible, and then it rises to this great, you know, rhythm that we're familiar with trains.
Yeah, well, Valentina Margoletti is playing the drums on this track, and she's an absolutely magnificent drummer. There's also the boran, sometimes pronounced boran, instrument, traditional Irish instrument that's being played as well there by Kieran Leonard. And I think the combination of those two, these sort of rolling toms played by Valentina and the boran, creates a very sort of visceral feeling of wheels turning along a track, and it's like that the rhythm of a train that's cutting through a landscape. But I don't think when I wrote it, I didn't think perhaps so literally as that. I just thought it'd be nice to have a really building a slow build drum track here that moves towards this the climax of this song about the tree that is being felled. Which kind of stands in for all trees being cut down wherever they are, but also is perhaps could be about a person who's being cut down and the loss of a person. All the songs on the album could be seen two ways. You can either interpret them as being about the relationship with the earth, weather, or things on the earth, people on the earth, cars, trees, birds, and so on, all the phenomena that surround us, or about the love and feeling we have for each other as humans and the difficult things that happen. People cut down before their time, grieving for the losses that we've had, or the loves that we have, those that we have and those that we've lost. So the songs, I hope it doesn't sound, when I'm talking about them, it can sound as if it's like a lecture about the environment. It's not. It's songs about love, the reaching to the heart, but also to hopefully provoking new, different, slightly different ways of thinking about how we relate to the physical world around us, the natural world around us, as well as to each other as humans.
Yeah, well, and our just our relationship to place. Some years ago, a friend of mine used this word vivaxis, and I said, "What does that mean?" She said, "Well, I think it was medieval times. There was this belief that where you were, your body was somehow married to that place in the earth. You know, that this was a determiner of behavior and all of these things and who you loved." And in some ways, we might look at that as primitive, but I also believe that there is, in a way, something to that.
Yeah, it's like love the one you're with. If you can't be with the one you love, love you the one you're with. If you can't travel, love where you are. But loving where you are and loving, I was just reading an article about it the other day, actually, the concept of here-ness, the idea of being here, where you are, opening your eyes to the qualities of wherever you are, whatever those qualities and spaces and places may be. And I think that connection with land, people who've lost their land or who are in exile or who have had to leave often talk about their homeland with this enormous longing and yearning, this kind of my land, as if it's a part of their body that they've lost. I think if you've lived in the same place for much of your life, you don't know what that feeling of loss is like until you lose it, or until you have to go. Many exiles or people who've had to leave war zones or whose houses and things have been destroyed in war, the kind of grief for their place on earth, what you were just saying, really, where they were born and where they perhaps feel they would rather die. It can be a fantastically strong connection.
I think one of the things that is evident too here is the just the music of everyday life, that music is not just something that emanates from a piano. It emanates from the world around us.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. Sound is music. And as a filmmaker, I've obviously been working with soundtracks for a very long time, and with the realization, the more soundtracks you work with, that when you're doing a score, for example, you're just adding to the music that is there in the sound already of a street or a room or people talking or the rain falling or the many, many other sounds that we don't always categorize as music, but which are, in fact, music. But of course, there is still a place for music that calls itself music and is arranged and rehearsed and perfected and recorded, or maybe improvised, it depends. But which we name as music and want to listen to as music and want to listen to particular musicians. Like I've been working with particular musicians whose work I love and who I write for in part. So, for example, Fred Frith, who plays guitar on most of the tracks, and who, when I'm writing the guitar lines, I hear his sound, which is a very unique sound. I hear that in my inner ear, and I'm imagining him playing it. And so it's kind of almost trying to transpose myself into his body and his guitar in order to generate the approximate sound that I then is then turned into a score, and then he receives and then turns it into the real Fred sound that I'd imagined before. But I think that's part of it, is honoring as well or being inspired by actually particular specific musicians.
You mentioned earlier, this idea that you didn't, you said, "Oh, I wasn't thinking anything as literally as this train." But once you have the songs and you're sort of getting into the studio and you've thought about things like, "Oh, I think Fred would, do something interesting with this. I think this player might do interesting." Do you just kind of say, "Okay, you do what you do. You're here because you're excellent in this," or do you have very specific directions that you give them?
Well, they're written parts for a start, so they are there to be played as parts. But when I hear them play what I'd written, I sometimes think, oh, well, that might be better now that I hear it a little bit more like this, for example. Or let's, we've just been talking about Fred. Fred might say, well, that particular chord might be nicer played like this. Or how about if we do this bit up the octave or something like that? So there'll be suggestions that will come that then, perhaps reshape what was written. But people tend to do the parts pretty strictly as written, actually. But I then, depending on the player, will often also offer up the possibility of an improvised line that might add something. So I might ask them, are you hearing something here that you think would be interesting? What about using the ebow here for something to create this kind of sound? So we'll talk about it and collaborate a little bit, or Fred might improvise a line around the chord structure that I've already given. And the same thing would apply to some of the other musicians too. So there's give and take, but in this case, with this album, it already had a sort of clear shape. But the musicians bring it to life and improve it with their skill, their interpretive skill.
There must be something very magical about taking something that you've written on the page and then seeing it come to life like that with the players.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's often very moving for me. I sometimes find the first time I hear something played as it really should be played, and as I dreamed of it for months, writing, revising, changing a bit here, changing a bit there, and so on and so forth, then I hear it played, and I often find I'm then weeping for a bit, slightly shy and embarrassed about the fact that I'm weeping about something I've written. But generally speaking, the musicians are very kind to me at that point, and perhaps also feel flattered because what they're doing has moved me And it's like we're serving each other in a way with what we can give. I'm trying to give to them something that will bring out qualities in them that are their best, beautiful qualities. And then they no doubt are then offering back to me what they've done. So it's an exchange. It's a kind of circular exchange of writing and interpretation, and in some cases improvising. And certainly in some of my earlier film scores, many of the lines were initially improvised and then edited and rearranged and put together.
Well, I want to ask quickly about a couple of pieces on the album, one of which is Elegy. And to me, the album has so much movement and motion and so forth. And Elegy is almost this kind of study in stillness in its way.
Yes, well, where quite a lot of the other pieces are have quite complex harmonic, melodic arrangements and lines and interweaving lines and so on. In effect, Elegy is almost like a drone, a very, very deep drone played on double bass, and with a sort of a chord that just comes and goes sort of in on the played on the cello that comes and goes in sort of waves. And it was three double basses playing actually, so it's a very, very rich, low bassy sound, and with these moving chords, and then with some harmonics on the top, and the vocal line moves in and around this chord, which is not a change. It's not a chord sequence. It's the same chord over and over, but the vocal line moves in and around that, almost like a prayer, like a sort of. And going through the elements of water, fire, air, and earth in that order. Blessings. Bless you, bless you. Bless you, air, bless you, earth, and so on. Slightly more complex lyrics than that, but that's essentially what it is. After the, you know, some of the sort of the noise and activity and fullness of the other tracks, I wanted to strip it right back to the elements, literally, and to the honoring the elements, yes.
Oh, daughter, which I think you wrote or said, not having literal children, but I feel like this sometimes where it's like if I don't have literal children, I do have many people in my life who are kind of children to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of emphasis on bloodlines, on biological children, and the kind of vertical line backwards through history, you know, my father, my mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, and so on, the family tree and all that stuff, and so-called family values and so on. And many of those things are very beautiful, the loyalties that happen in families, the sense of place actually of belonging and so on. But sometimes we forget that we are related horizontally. You know, we are all each other's children in a way, or each other's parents. We and if we forget that, we're in trouble. This kind of, you know, shut the door, lock the gate, get inside and only care about your own is a terribly limited vision when there's all these people everywhere that we can relate to in much more profound ways and pleasurable ways actually to chosen families. So the song "O Daughter" is addressed to my daughter, a daughter I don't physically biologically have. I do have goddaughters who I love, but it's really to all daughters. The song is to all daughters, but it's always better to write something singular, specific, and then other people can extrapolate from that and make it be about their daughters or their whoever they want. But yes, it's about a song of sort of love and warning to a daughter, or all daughters.
I wonder if you consider yourself a learner, that you can learn something from somebody who's maybe far less experienced at something than you, or whatever, that other people do constantly have something to teach you.
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of the thing called beginner mind, where you basically feel that you're just starting out. And I do feel that. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I often do things at an age that people would, generally speaking, consider perhaps a little inappropriate. But I think the feeling that, you know, that at any point one can begin, you know, you can begin again, because in effect there is only today, what we've done in the past, including the mistakes and the triumphs and the failures and so on, are behind us. We can't do anything about them. What's coming tomorrow is tomorrow. It's not here yet, so we can plan ahead, but other things might happen and get in the way. But what we do have is today. So we can be in today and celebrate today and learn today and start anew today. And when you think that way, that opens a lot of doors. It suddenly thinks, oh, well, if it really is today, if this is my life now, not a dress rehearsal for some future life that I might or might not have, then it's a very good moment to get started and to learn whatever. In the process, for example, of doing the last three albums, the last two songwriting albums and the soundtrack album before that, I was learning Logic Pro, which is something I compose on. And at the beginning, I was feeling really klutzy. You know, it's like, oh, my God, I'm never going to get my head around all this technical this, that and the other. But quite quickly, I discovered that it was rather very, very, very similar to working with film strips. It's so linear in its design and so on. And I began to get a facility for it. And then I found myself feeling fantastically proud of myself. And it reminded me of like in ancient times when I sent my first email. You know, I thought I was a genius because I'd sent an email. But you know, now I wish I weren't so many emails in my inbox. But anyway, that's another matter. But yes, it's never too late to start, and it's never too late to start learning something you really want to learn.
You've been listening to a conversation with Sally Potter. Potter's new album, Anatomy, is out May 2nd via Bella Union. You can learn more about Sally Potter and both her music and films at sallypotter.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We will see you next time.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.